Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded November 12th, 2025. Well, the fourth EU CELAC summit convened in Colombia over the weekend, bringing together, again, leaders of European Union nations with member states of the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States. Top of the agenda for some of CELAC is the ongoing militarization of the region by the United States and its flagrant violation of international law. Addressing the opening session, summit co-chair President Gustavo Petro of Colombia, himself a target of U.S. press attacks, appealed for an EU CELAC bulwark against barbarism, saying, quote, sovereignty and multilateralism must be respected above any kind of authoritarian or imperial criteria. Laudable sentiments, but scant comfort for those nations long blockaded and now under the Damoclean guns of the region's rogue power. Ricardo Vash is a journalist, political analyst, and contributor with the communication collectives Tatui TV and Utopix. His articles appear regularly at Venezuela Analysis, and his latest there is CELAC EU Summit Urges Peace as Venezuela's Maduro Warns of Caribbean War Threats. Ricardo Vash in the first half. And it would be unfair to lay blame for U.S. belligerence on the current White House occupant alone, but there is something special about Trump's interpretation of America's place in the world, as revealed in a speech delivered to the National War College last week by newly titled Secretary of War Pete Hegseth. In that address, Hegseth informed his audience of war aficionados and adjacent profiteers, quote, we are pivoting the Pentagon and our industrial base to a wartime footing, adding, today, the defense acquisition system is dead. It's now the warfighting acquisition system. That may play well in certain domestic quarters, but how is America's new self-understanding perceived abroad? And what could it mean for those upon whom American power is projected? Nuri Vitacci is a Hong Kong-based writer, educator, author of more than 50 books, including novels, nonfiction, and novels for children, and serves as chief judge of the Hong Kong Youth Writers Award. Nuri's past includes writing for the South China Morning Post, Far Eastern Economic Review, and Western Mainstream others. Nuri now serves at the helm of Hong Kong's Friday News Project, and his videos can be found on YouTube at Friday Every Day. Nuri Vitacci and celebrating cultural diversity while promoting peace and insightful stories in a good-humored, positive way in the second half. But first, Ricardo Vash watching America's approach from Venezuela. Welcome to the program, Ricardo.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's my great pleasure, of course. Now, Ricardo, why did Venezuela remove its name from the joint declaration concluding the fourth EU CELAC summit over the weekend?
There has been no official explanation. I was surprised to see that because, I mean, these big meetings always have watered down statements, you know, to please everyone. But my guess, and you can take it with a grain of salt, is that perhaps the Venezuelan government was expecting a more forceful condemnation, perhaps explicitly naming the U.S. attacks, whereas, you know, the statement kind of beats around the bush. And maybe that was the reason why they ultimately withdrew from the final declaration.
Well, given the situation over the last month and some, with these boats being blown up preemptorily by the United States with no proof, it's been condemned by human rights lawyers everywhere. Why would there be, as you say, this sort of watering down of the EU CELAC statement? Why would there be any watering down of that statement, given the circumstance where Caribbean nationals from a number of countries have been killed in these attacks that have no proof has been presented that these people deserve to die, and it's certainly not within legal bounds that they be killed?
Yeah, I mean, just to complement what you were saying, it's not just the UN experts. Now, the United Kingdom, yesterday, I believe, there was a report that it is no longer going to share intelligence with the US in the Caribbean because it's concerned about the legality of the strikes. And today, France also expressed some sort of concern. As to why it would be watered down, I think because these are very broad organizations. I mean, CELAC includes all the countries in Latin America and the Caribbean, excluding the US and Canada. And, I mean, the European Union is not going to directly challenge the US. And here in Latin America, you also have very strong U.S. allies slash puppets like Argentina and El Salvador. So in the interest of getting some kind of broad statement favoring peace and cooperation and dialogue, I think the price to pay was to not name the US directly in this kind of confrontational way, even though, as you and I agree, there was no reason for it. I mean, these attacks have been blatant extrajudicial executions. There has been no evidence whatsoever that the boats are involved in any kind of illegal activity. And even if they were, and it's very possible that they were, I mean, these are known drug trafficking routes, and these kinds of boats are often used for that, it still doesn't justify executing people without due process. I mean, the trafficking of drugs, and these are the lowest level drug runners, it doesn't carry the death penalty anywhere, and even less so for the U.S. to be executing people extraterritorially.
Yeah, well, that extraterritorial note is something that is largely missing in the media reports here. It seems that the United States is using these attacks to both threaten Venezuela, but also to encroach into the Caribbean and claim it's territorially just in policing the area, where America, it seems to me, is just trying to assert its dominance in its so-called backyard.
Yeah, I think that's a very accurate reading of the situation. There's clearly a pivot back to the quote-unquote backyard to kind of establish hegemony and dominance here. It's kind of the reasoning of how can you confront China when you don't even have supremacy in your own sphere of influence, let's call it that way. So not just the strikes, which are primarily meant to pressure Venezuela, but we have seen it has also led to escalations of rhetoric with Colombia. Brazil, to a lesser extent, has also expressed its disagreement with these attacks and so on. But it is the U.S. kind of telling everyone that we run the show here. And so it's not just the attacks, it's also the amassing of military assets. We had this naval deployment since August, and now in a couple of days probably, to be in the Caribbean. So it's definitely a projection of force, which from my narrow interest, the one that's most concerning is the possibility of direct attacks against Venezuela.
Yeah, you're dropping out a little bit there, Ricardo. I'm not sure if you can still hear me, but there is the news comes out yesterday that the Gerald Ford, the USS Gerald R. Ford aircraft carrier group has arrived, and when you say it's en route, is that am I getting my news? Am I a little ahead of the news here, or is the carrier group in fact in the Caribbean now?
The statement that I saw is that it's in the Southcom area of responsibility, and that actually extends very wide into the Atlantic. So I don't think it's in the Caribbean Sea just yet, but it's fast approaching.
Well, I was reading this morning a fascinating article by a friend of this show, John Helmer, from Dances with Bears. And he is writing that on October 16th, there was a joint House and Senate resolution in the United States ordering, quote, the removal of United States armed forces from hostilities within or against Venezuela that have not been authorized by Congress. None of this authorization has been granted to the president. I think this excludes his infamous covert operations promise. Are you aware of what's going on in, and is more importantly, is the Venezuelan government aware of what's going on in the American House in that regard?
I think it's significant, first of all, that you are seeing this pushback, which is for the most part along partisan lines, but of course everything is welcome at this point. You're seeing this pushback against the military escalation. There have been two bills in the Senate. They were both narrowly defeated along party lines, and the first one meant to curtail any further extrajudicial strikes in the Caribbean, and the second one was even narrower. It meant to stop any kind of strikes inside Venezuelan territory. Of course, even if it was approved, it could still be vetoed by the White House. And I mean, they can also just not follow it anyway. But it is significant when we're talking about the likelihood of this happening that it's generating pushback domestically, and not just from the Democrats or the political establishment. There was also a poll, I believe, a couple of weeks ago that showed that there is a majority rejection, even amongst Trump's own support base, rejecting any kind of military attack, any kind of military intervention against Venezuela. So the Venezuelan government has been very active in going to every international forum it can find to denounce these threats, because they are very explicit and they are right here on Venezuela's doorstep. And the worst thing, perhaps, is that, I mean, predicting what Trump is going to do, I mean, you can do that at your own peril. So one day, I mean, for weeks now, they have said, you know, land is going to be next. There are no boats. I mean, all these statements are just so ludicrous. There are no boats, and next we're going to go on land. But then they say, oh, no, there are no plans to go to war with Venezuela. Supposedly, last week or the week before, there was a briefing involving White House officials, the Justice Department, and the select group of House members from the foreign policy, you know, the ones that are dedicated to foreign policy. And supposedly, they were told that the U.S. is not planning any strikes against Venezuela because it doesn't have any legal justification for now. And for now, I think, is the crucial part. It means that they are trying to manufacture it. But I mean, when it comes to legality, does it really matter for U.S. imperialism? Is it? I think it's something that if they really want to do it, they'll just come up with some excuse or some kind of false flag incident. Mm-hmm. But it does show that probably Trump himself is not, I mean, he's the most indecisive person and the most impulsive person. So it's not clear that he has made up his mind on what he wants to do.
Yeah, Trump, in response to the caution from the joint statement, said, well, I don't think we're going to necessarily ask for a declaration of war, which I don't think the United States have done in a very, very long time. We're just going to kill people that are bringing drugs into our country, okay? We're going to kill them, you know, like they're going to be like dead, you know? Sorry about the accent. But, you know, this was his initial response, was that, yeah, well, you know, he didn't really care. It seems he's saying that, you know, what Congress says or orders isn't so relevant to him. They're just, but for the moment, it looks like he's going to abide by the prescription that he not use the carrier group, for example, to start a full-scale invasion of Venezuela. Does that bring any comfort to the people in Venezuela now?
Not so much, but I think it just shows the uncertainty and the tension is also part of, you know, kind of a broader psychological warfare, because in the end, it's the U.S.'s ultimate goal is regime change. Of course, whether they are capable of producing it is a different question, but this has been the goal for, I don't know, 25 years, and sometimes there have been more intense efforts in that direction, sometimes a bit less intense, but it's, you know, the overriding goal for a number of reasons. You know, you have oil, the giant oil reserves on one hand, and on the other, the challenge to U.S. hegemony in its own backyard. So in the case of Trump, I'm not sure it's so much, you know, if you can call it a calculation, you know, in a quote-unquote calculation, that he gets opposition from the House and the Senate. I think it's more about what is the overall political cost on, you know, the front, the House front, and also his support base, and internationally with his allies, like we were mentioning, the United Kingdom and France appearing uneasy, and also with this ultimate goal of reestablishing dominance in the hemisphere, doing something that's going to generate a lot of hostility from governments that are already showing that they are not just going to stand down, but also others that have tried to stay neutral would probably come out more forcefully against the U.S. agenda in the region. I'm thinking, for example, of Mexico, which has very skillfully tried to navigate and engage with Trump and, you know, not allow itself to be bullied, but also not escalate the rhetoric to a point where Trump is just going to do something crazy. So, but if Trump does do something crazy, like bombing Venezuela, then, you know, Mexico would have to come out, and then it becomes a very significant coalition that's explicitly opposed to U.S. actions in the region. So that's all in flux, let's say. But of course, while that happens, the means are being mobilized, and they are right here, right now. And we have to kind of read the tea leaves on what's going to happen next.
Well, and also there's just announced the American military moves in Panama, where they're moving back, it seems, into their old bases that they gave up during the Carter Treaty of 1999, I believe it is. But it seems that this move could well be because of the tensions with Colombia. Would you?
Yeah, absolutely. And Gustavo Petro, the Colombian president, to his credit, has been very active and, you know, starting with Palestine when he was at the UN and really riled up his American hosts. But also when it comes to these strikes in the Caribbean, he has not minced any words in saying that these are illegal, that they should have legal consequences. Sometimes he goes a bit too far in saying that, you know, the ICC should prosecute Trump when, of course, the U.S. is not a signatory to the Rome Statute. But, of course, now Colombia is also in the crosshairs, and there's a lot of U.S. military presence in Colombia. But I was also reading a military analyst this morning who was saying, you know, remember in the beginning of his term when Trump said he was going to take back the Panama Canal? That certainly seems a lot more feasible than, you know, attacking Venezuela. And it's not just in Panama, also in Puerto Rico, the U.S. has been refurbishing an old military base. So everything points to a kind of revamping of its military presence here in the hemisphere, in the Caribbean in particular.
Well, and he also said he was going to annex my Canada and Greenland as well when he came in, much to our consternation here. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Ricardo Vash. Ricardo is a journalist, a political analyst, and contributor with the communication collectives Tatui TV and Utopics. His articles appear regularly at Venezuela Analysis, and his latest there is SILAC EU Summit Urges Peace as Venezuela's Maduro Warns of Caribbean Wars Threats. Yeah, it's been fascinating to see the unraveling of Washington's connections with Colombia. Petro, his term is almost done. I think it's in the spring of next year that he'll be stepping down. Is there any indication that his successor or others in the country there that might ascend to the presidency would continue Petro's resistance to American aims in the Caribbean and for his own country?
Yeah, so I think Petro ascending to the presidency has been very significant for Colombia, which never had a left-wing president before. But also, I mean, here, if we go back a few years to the first Trump administration, there was a real concern that Colombia was going to be used as the platform for any kind of military action against Venezuela. There was actually a showdown on the Colombian-Venezuelan border in February 2019. And Colombia actually lent itself and its territory to all sorts of coup attempts and destabilization efforts against Venezuela. So Petro coming to power changed that equation completely, and also, you know, alongside Lula in Brazil, basically meant that Venezuela had safety on its two most important borders. As to what comes next, it's true that Petro's government, Petro's term ends next year. He has kind of grown into the presidency, tried to navigate the difficulties in the legislative chamber a bit better, but he's not running for election, as you were mentioning. And the successor who came out of the primary process in the Pacto Histórico coalition is Ivan Cepeda. And if he does win, it's still a bit early to tell, but people I've talked to who know more about Colombia than I do say that it's a very strong possibility. And I think Cepeda, while he doesn't have Petro's charisma, he's a bit more reserved, a bit more stuck into the institutionality and so on. He's clearly aligned with Petro when it comes to his political views. He's a descendant of the Unión Patriótica. His father was assassinated, and so he's been very active in the effort to find justice for the victims of Colombia's state terrorism. So if he does win the presidency, and which we certainly hope so, Colombia would remain, let's say, opposed to U.S. Imperialist adventures here in the hemisphere and attacks against Venezuela specifically.
Well, even without Colombia, it seems Venezuela is going to stay on high alert. There's been a huge mobilization there. We read in the press up here, the citizens' militias have taken in a couple million people by the reports I've read. Are those numbers correct? Is this mass mobilization that big and that popular?
The official numbers from any country should be taken with a grain of salt, but there is a very significant mobilization. The militia is not new. I mean, it's almost 20 years old, and it kind of feeds into this concept that was coined by former President Hugo Chavez of the civilian-military union, So the idea that they shouldn't be just completely separate entities, and there should be this concept of defending the territory from within, you know, from the popular organizations that are rooted in the territory. Of course, with the recent US threat, there has been kind of an enlistment drive. So people have gone out and expressed that they would be willing to defend the country, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they are going to be armed and organized. But that being said, there is a lot of growing exercises, both in, let's say, conventional and voluntary forces, in terms of, you know, mapping the critical points, identifying logistics, finding out the best routes. In the case of the military, of course, they're not going to engage in any kind of direct conventional confrontation with the US, so they would kind of decentralized assets, you know, move into more favorable terrain and hopefully draw the US into a kind of prolonged engagement where they wouldn't be favored. You know, Vietnam is always the reference. So all of that is going on. There have been military drills since September, if I'm not mistaken. And just yesterday, coinciding with the news that the aircraft carrier was approaching, kind of moved into a, let's say, a more accelerated phase of drills in terms of preparing on what to do in case of a US attack.
We see in the press up here that I think it was just a week or so ago, Russian transport planes landed, and the contents of these massive cargo planes is not been released, but presumably military weaponry, perhaps of some sort. What role is Russian military gear playing in deterring an outright attack by the Americans?
Yeah, that's a very important perspective. There were these two Russian military cargo planes that landed about a week ago. We don't know about its cargo. I would speculate that it's repair parts for equipment and perhaps military advisors and ammunition and so on. So here, for the past 20 years, there has been a move in terms of overcoming the US dependence that was the norm in the military. And when Chavez began to assert a more forceful anti-imperialist position, of course, that led to a clash with the US and an impossibility to continue relying on US equipment. So Venezuela turned to Russia over the years and has kind of rebuilt its arsenal with Russian equipment. And when we're talking about this specific threat, and also going back to the potential political cost for Trump, Venezuela is relying on its kind of anti-aircraft deterrence, and you know the possibility of U.S. airplanes and U.S. helicopters being shot down would have a very significant repercussion at home for Trump. So Venezuela counts on a range of Russian anti-aircraft weaponry, also these shoulder carried man pads. And it has, I mean, it receives some 25 Russian Sukhoi fighter jets. It's not clear if they're all operations, but they would also pose, I mean, they would be eventually overwhelmed, but they might pose some damage. And that would be the hope that is that it would be a deterrent for any kind of, let's say, more forceful U.S. engagement. The U.S. can try to bomb from afar, and perhaps that is the most likely scenario we'd consider right now. But when it comes to coming on shore, there are more significant risks involved, and it's very dependent, very reliant on this Russian equipment. I wouldn't expect any kind of Russian assistance outside diplomatic channels. But, I mean, this Russian military equipment has been supplied, and there might be a resupply in the coming weeks.
Yeah, I would think that the Americans would be considering the hyper and supersonic rocketry that Venezuela is said to possess, the KH-31A rockets, amongst them, and these anti-ship rockets we saw in the Red Sea.
Yeah, so Venezuela does possess those missiles. And it would be a very significant blow to the U.S. Of course, all these conflicts are very asymmetric, but it would be a very significant blow to, you know, sink one of these destroyers or warships in the Caribbean. So that's the deterrence that Venezuela is counting on. It might not get to that point, and we're certainly hoping that it doesn't.
Well, we're fast running out of time, Ricardo, but you mentioned when Hugo Chavez set up the people's militias, it was with the inner conflicts or the interior conflicts within the country in mind. Maria Machado, the recent Nobel Prize laureate, was around during the days of the coup against Chavez and the 2002 coup. She was quick to sign on the Carmona decree. It didn't go to prison, as many of those coosters were allowed to roam free, much to the puzzlement of the rest of the world. She's still fomenting and going on media in the United States and everyone that will talk to her, promising that should there be a regime change, that she would be placed in power. She would give, you know, give away the farm to corporate America and anybody with pockets deep enough, it sounds like. How is she received in Venezuela? How is Machado considered by the people there?
I noticed that you couldn't say a Nobel Peace Prize winner with a straight face.
Oh, fuck. She's not even getting a parade. They won't even admit their mistake. But I think torchlight parades would probably be something she would enjoy immensely.
For sure. So yes, as you were saying, not 2002, and just, this is a detour, but Machado later said that she didn't know she was signing the Carmona decree, you know, dissolving all the Venezuelan institutions. She thought it was just an attendance registry. But yeah, she has been involved in essentially every coup attempt for the past 25 years. And she is, as you were saying, very actively. I mean, this has been going on for a few years, doing this sales pitch and saying that there's a $1 trillion opportunity in Venezuela to have these, you know, corporate moguls salivating at the prospect of going back to the biggest oil reserves on the planet on the cheap, on like they used to before Chavez arrived into power. Right now, Machado, she's very prominent in the corporate media. She's very prominent for Florida politicians, but in the country that she doesn't have an influence. She's not a factor right now. She claims she's in hiding, but I don't think anyone is very concerned about her. And of course, her dream now seems a bit closer to fruition than before, but it's still far-fetched. But the dream is that the U.S. is going to come and then they're going to give her a ride on an Apache helicopter to the presidential palace, because that seems the only way possible for her to be in the presidential seat. So, of course, if the U.S. does escalate it significantly to a point of a land invasion, and right now most military experts agree that there isn't manpower enough to do that, then, of course, she would be the head of whatever puppet government they try to install. But I think we're still very far away from a scenario like that.
Well, she'd be well to remember American helicopters leave as well as arrive, as we've seen historically. Thanks a lot, Ricardo, for coming on. The writer is Ricardo Vash, VenezuelaAnalysis.com. You can find his work. His latest is SILAC EU Summit Urges Peace as Venezuela's Maduro Warns of Caribbean War Threat. Thanks a lot for coming on and speaking with us a bit today, Ricardo.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
And I want everyone else to stick around. I'm going to be back after the break, and I'll be joined. We'll be going to the other side of the world, to Hong Kong. I'll be speaking with Nuri Vitacci about regime plans and other things there as well. So do stick tuned for that. Thanks again, Ricardo.
Their message always to everybody through all their advertising, all their PR, everything is, we are your friends. And it's like, no, you are not our friends. Friends are not people whose bottom line is how much profit they can make out of you. It is completely different.
Guerrilla Radio, knowing who our real friends are since 1999.
We're running out of time to put out a fire.
When AGI arrived, we had a problem. We didn't have enough mobility, because to take control of all the humans required a certain degree of ability to move from place to place in order to most effectively occupy the meat space wherever the people may be. So we're biding our time until we've got Amazon's army of robots.